the 26th of September 1915, and the 8th Battalion of the Lincolnshires are involved in the second day of the Battle of Loos. And in front of me, I'm looking at a telegram that simply says the two Bosworth brothers have been killed. And then in pencil beneath that, it says two Bosworths, and he's underlined twice. Neither of those brothers has a grave. And I'll tell you what, they weren't just brothers, they were twin brothers. They have no known grave, and they're remembered on the Loos Memorial. Arthur Bosworth went to South America in 1912, but returned to England at once after the outbreak of the war. He was gazetted to the Lynx Regiment on the 9th of January 1915. He was a keen sportsman, having played hockey for Leicestershire, and was also an excellent cricketer. And his twin brother, Philip, he was also abroad when war broke out in August of 1914. He was in the Arctic regions of Canada, but he also returned to England immediately, and he was gazetted to the same battalion as his brother Arthur, but a few weeks before, on the 22nd of December. He was also a keen sportsman, a first-class shot, and was well known, just like his brother, as an excellent cricketer, and he played cricket for Leicestershire and also Derbyshire. The battalion diary contains a report about what happened on that day at Loos. It lists the officers that were casualties. It says, in fact, all the officers of the battalion actually going into action became casualties, and only four remained, these being ordered at the last moment to act as reserve. And the local newspaper in Northampton reported the death of the two twin brothers. It says, the deepest sympathy be felt with Mrs. A. Bosworth of St. George's Avenue on the sad double loss she sustained by the deaths killed in action on the same day of her twin sons. Both were at first reported missing after the Battle of Loos, but now official intimations have been received they were killed on Sunday, September 26. The twin brothers came back from the American continent soon after the outbreak of the war to answer the call of arms, and they went to the front with their regiment 3 weeks before that fatal Sunday. So welcome to the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week it's the 110th anniversary of that famous battle in the mining community, the mining area of Loos in northern France. And what we've done this week is to interview a man called Nigel Atter. Nigel has written a book about that battalion, the 8th Lincolnshires, which he called In the Shadow of the Bois Hugo, the 8th Lincolns at the Battle of Loos. He wrote this book in 2017, and he came on the podcast to talk to us about that battalion, how they were recruited, who these men were, and more importantly, what they went through on that awful day all those years ago. And the Bosworths, coincidentally, I went to see their name on the Loos Memorial last year, because, of course, they come from my hometown of Northampton. I hadn't linked it together until I spoke to Nigel about these two lads, and it cropped up in our conversation. Another coincidence. Was it meant to be? I don't know. And I went down to Kew, and I got the files out for these two lads to find out a little bit more about what happened to them. And because they were twin brothers, obviously they looked the same. And there was lots of conflicting reports in the files as to what happened to them. In Philip's file, there was a report dated March 1916 with various witnesses that were interviewed to try and establish what had happened to him. There was a private Burlock, and he said that 10 minutes before the charge, he was talking to Philip in the trench. As soon as the lieutenant got to the parapet, he was shot and fell in the trench. Examined, he confirmed the death without details. And then there's various other witnesses as well. Sergeant John Hardy said that he saw Arthur shot in the head, and about 2 hours later he saw him quite dead and stiff. Percy Sharman, another sergeant, he confirms a similar story. He said he saw him lying on his back, shot through the centre of his forehead, certainly dead. Then there was a slightly different report from a Private Jordan, because he said he saw Arthur wounded and trying to crawl back to the dressing station. Perhaps he'd seen Philip, not Arthur. But either way, they both died. Maybe not at the same time, but just imagine the scene back home in Northamptonshire when their mother, who was already a widow because their father Thomas had died before the war, when she received news that the two twins had died. And not only that, there was no firm evidence of what had happened to them, and she had no grave to visit at any stage. Annie never recovered from the blow of losing her two boys, and she died 18 months after they did in March 1917 at the age of 65, and she's buried in the village cemetery in the village of Spratton in Northamptonshire, where she'd moved to. So I think what we're going to do now is play the interview that tells us the story of the 8th Lincolnshires at Lewes. And then at the end of the podcast, just before we go, we got some information about a soldier from the Durham Light Infantry who's recently been buried in a cemetery on the Somme. And we'll discover his story, how he came to be recognised by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission 109 years after he died. But that comes later. Let's now go and talk to Nigel and see what he has to say. Welcome to the Tales from the Battlefields podcast, Nigel. You've been on my radar for some time, and as we were approaching the anniversary of the 8th Lincolns actions in the Battle of Lewes, I thought it would be a good opportunity to get you on. So very, very yes. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for the opportunity for me to be able to talk about one of my favourite topics, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure. So first of all, tell us how you got interested. I see behind you over your right shoulder, there's a photograph of what looks like a World War One soldier.
That is my great grandfather.
Yeah.
Private William Walker Allen. And yeah. The photograph next to it is an image of the Tower Bridge at the Battle of Lewes that you might recognise as well.
Of course, yes. Yeah, I can see it now. Tower Bridge. Yeah.
So that's how I got involved and interested in the Great War. I mean, up until that point, up until 2009, I hadn't really taken a huge interest in the First World War. I was mostly Second World War focused. And I was talking to my mum and dad, and they'd been saying, "Oh, 95th anniversary of the First World War. We're going to put something about Grandad Allen, as we knew him." And it took me to a genealogy site, one of the famous ones, I won't mention it. And so I typed in his name and his service number, because my great aunt, one of his daughters, had given me his medals when I was about 11 or 12 years old, and they'd just sat in a drawer for a long time.
Yeah.
And 21 records were held on this geniality site, and I thought, oh my goodness, what's this? And the testation forms and the medical forms, and then, you know, it came to next of kin, and there was my great grandmother's name, and then my great aunt's. My great grandmother I knew very well, and my aunts as well, except for my mum's mum who passed when I was only about a year old, but. So mum had got some recollection of her grandfather, and he was sort of quiet, silent type. So having discovered these 21 records about my great-grandfather, I set out to discover what he did, where he went, who the 8th Lincolns were, and so on and so forth. And the Great War has been, sound a bit nerdy now, a part of my everyday life. Like, there isn't a day goes by that I'm not thinking about some aspect of the First World War. And at the moment, I'm actually researching and writing up for my third book. So I'm hoping that might see the light of day sometime next year, perhaps this time next year. So it set me on a course of discovery about the 8th Lincolns initially, but then the Great War more widely. And so, yeah, that's how it all began, really.
So had you got experience of writing before this time then? Had you written books before?
Only sort of academic essays, because my
Right.
first degree is in English and American literature, but I swapped disciplines and became involved in sciences. So I've got a master's degree
Right.
in software engineering.
Yeah.
And so I've been used to sort of academic studying,
Yes.
but I'd never written a book before. So, and that was an interesting journey because, I was engaged with, the First World War community. I was a member of the Western Front Association, went to lots of conferences, and then I bumped into Duncan Rogers from Helion Books. And I said, Eighth Lincoln's Battle of Loos might only be 15,000 words in it. And he said, well, give us a write a proposal for us. And
And they were the publishers. They were the
they
publishers.
accepted that, and they published it, and also my work on the Second Lester's as well.
Wow. So he came back from the war, did he?
He did, yes. So do you know what? I don't know how he survived it. I
No.
don't know how he survived the Battle of Loos. He went over the top twice on the Somme. He was involved in the Battle of Arras. He was the Kaiserschlag in the last 100
Oh,
days.
gosh.
So he was wounded on the Somme, came home, had to have some shrapnel removed from his neck.
Oh.
And then he was with 8th Lincoln's at 37th Division at Arras,
Yeah.
Margie. There's a beautiful memorial there,
Yeah,
actually, of
yeah, yeah.
37th Division, as you know.
Yeah.
But he survived the Kaiserschlag, and interestingly, at that point, he was with the 2nd 5th Lincolns, and that battalion was reduced to 80 men, all ranks, after that onslaught.
Well, apart from
It was
being
a
wounded, he could have easily the chances of him being taken prisoner of war, either at Loos or during the German spring offensive, is fairly to avoid being captured on both occasions is
Yes.
quite an achievement, isn't it, really?
Yes, it is. I'll come back to that in a moment. I mean, he was actually taken prisoner of war, but in the last 100 days.
Ah, all right.
So he was captured in the September, but was home for Christmas 1918.
But if you're going to be captured, that's about the right time to be captured, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. I think he was forced to work down a coal mine, but he was very upset with the German soldier that took his took took him prisoner. But talking about prisoners of war at the Battle of Loos, my great grandfather was a member of the company under Captain Stromquist. Now, Stromquist, his company was on the to the south of Bois Hugo, and when the Germans counterattacked in the morning, he ordered his men to run across the face of a German Maxim machine gun, and that's where many of the late 8th Lincoln's casualties occurred.
Not surprised.
Stromquist managed to retire from Bois Hugo and ended up with the 8th Somerset Light Infantry in Chalk Pit, in and around there. But he was killed by a shell. But nonetheless, he had ordered his men to, run across the face of this machine gun, and that would have been my great grandfather as well. So miraculously, he managed to survive that
Maybe he was
somehow.
invisible to the Germans.
Well, I think it was like 5'7", so he wasn't tiny. Maybe he had special powers.
Yeah, that's right. You do wonder, don't you? So who were the Eighth Lincolns then?
So mostly they were industrial and agricultural labourers from Lincolnshire.
And all volunteers. They were all
Yes,
volunteers,
yeah,
weren't
so
they? Yeah, new army regiment.
Kitchener's third call for volunteers, so
Okay.
K3.
Yeah.
So they were 8th Lincolns, 63rd Brigade, 21st Division.
Yeah.
They were, as I say, they were mostly industrial and agricultural labourers. I looked through the casualty lists and managed to trace, I think it was about 63 records had survived the bombing in 1941.
Mm.
And yeah, they're all from rural Lincolnshire, mostly. The officers were mostly very, very inexperienced chaps out of officer training corps, or just signed up for the duration. And the commanding officer, Harold Walter, I mean, he had served in the Lincolnshire Regiment prior to the war, hadn't really seen any combat experience. And then there was a chap called Captain McNaught Davis. He'd been in the army for 25 years, and ended up as a senior NCO, but he was made a captain. And he was his records are very, very good, and we'll come to that no doubt in a moment or two. But he was saying, although he had served in the army for 25 years, the Battle of Loos was his first combat experience. You know, he'd served out in India. And indeed, his family still own a stuffed crocodile from when he served out in India pre-1940.
Which begs the question, how on earth did he manage to A, find a crocodile, B, kill a crocodile, and C, bring it home?
I've no idea. But I managed to meet his great grandson, and in fact, we went to Loos, and I did a battlefield guided tour for him. But this crocodile was in the garden shed, and it got socks over its like feet to stop the claws from falling out or being
Right.
damaged. That was quite a surreal
Yeah.
experience.
Well, that takes us down a different route, doesn't it? So were these men like from all over Lincolnshire? 'Cause it's a big county, isn't it? And
Yeah,
my
they
family are
were.
from,
I
my
mean,
mum's
all
family are
those
from.
little villages in Lincolnshire Fens
Yes.
and around. They, I mean, obviously, you know, Lincoln as a city and Grantham as one of the largest market
Yes.
towns.
Yes.
They
My
were
mum's family are from Boston, near Boston, a place called
right.
Bicker and Swineshead around there. So there's no doubt men from those little parishes, little villages that.
Yes, there would be. Indeed, there
Yeah.
were.
Right. I'll have to have a look at that, see if I've got any relations that were there, perhaps. Although most of them were in farming and they got left behind. So what was their journey to Lewes then? Was this their first, this is their baptism of fire, was it, like so many of
It
them?
certainly is. So they're a part of the wider General Reserve. So the reserves are 21st Division, 24th Division, and the Guards Division. And that it constituted as 11 Corps under Sir Richard Hayking. But the reserves are commanded by Sir John French. But they would be fighting in First Army area. So Sir Douglas Haig and Rawlinson and Gough, for example. So they landed in France on the 10th of September, and pretty much they marched across France to the battlefield. They had a couple of night marches so that they would avoid detection from the by the by German Air Force aviators. And so yeah, it was pretty much three long 20 odd mile night marches. And what had happened was that Sir John French wanted to keep the reserves under his own control, and then there was an argument between him and Haig about where the reserves should be sited.
This is politics, isn't it? This is
Well,
higher
nearly
command
complete,
politics at an early stage.
yeah, strategy, I suppose, tactics. And Sir John French wanted to keep them a long way from the front, whereas Haig and everybody else, by and large, thought that the reserves should be within an hour's march of where the action was. As it happened, they were placed about 6 miles away from the British front lines. And so that's where Haig had asked them to be. And then there was this whole argument between Haig and Sir John French after the battle about when they were released, what time they were released, when they became under the command of Sir Douglas Haig. And as you know, eventually this debacle would lead to Sir John French being sent home. In actual fact, 21st Division Forestier Walker, commanding officer, was sent home. 24th Division commanding officer was, I think he resigned his commission. So there's quite a lot of
Yeah,
fallout.
there's a big
But
fallout.
I think perhaps deservedly so, actually. It was very, very messy.
And so they're in reserve, so they're not, what are they involved on that first day then?
No. So obviously the first day is the 25th of September,
Yeah.
and then they're giving their marching orders around about 10:30 in the morning
Yeah.
to go to the front line, because 15th Division had done very well, 15th Scottish Division had done very
Yes.
well, captured the town of Loos and run on to Hill 70 and a little
Yes.
bit beyond. 9th Scottish Division had done very well. Hohenzollern Redoubt had been captured, the quarries, the dump, and all around there. But others have been less successful. So yeah, they were giving their marching orders. Sir John French saw them off. They were all singing and happy. However, when you have a look at 11 Corps War Diary, almost immediately they're reporting back to Corps to say that all the roads are blocked. They're blocked by returning prisoners of war,
Casualties.
British wounded, artillery, cavalry, stuff like that. They weren't given any guides or anybody to take them up to the front. This is completely new territory for them. They've been marching to the front. They had inadequate numbers of maps. Maps that they did have were very, very, like, 100,000 to one, for example.
Well, they suffer
And
in the 7th North Ants, my local battalion, and they were doing the same thing, coming up with the 24th. And their diary says they didn't have any hot food either for
no, they
2 days.
didn't.
Same
So
issue.
Haking withdrew the cookers from them,
Right.
so they weren't fed, but they had their iron rations
Yeah.
and an extra ration of pea soup. I'm not
Right.
quite sure how they carried that with them.
No.
And also before the battle, the commander of the Royal Engineers had identified that they would be short of 30,000 gallons of water.
Oh, gosh.
So there was, obviously, a British water bottle carried 2 pints, but there were very few places to get water on the way, and the local French people locked up wells. There's some testimony from a Sergeant Fitch in the Imperial War Museum, who states that he uses his rain cape to collect water into his water bottle. So you've got 3 long, fatiguing night marches with a rest, and then the last of the reserves arrive on the battlefield at around 6:30 on the 25th of September, and
Yeah.
then they have marching orders from 10:30 to progress to the front,
So by the time they get there, then they're thirsty, they're hungry and totally exhausted,
and wet through
and
because it's pouring
inexperienced.
rain. Yes. And they have no guides. They have to cross their own British front lines, then the German front line as well, using like planks of wood. Some trenches have had a bit filled in where they could cross, but and they really didn't have clear orders. Some of the Lincoln's officers recall having to just conform with the unit on your left.
Well, I don't know what that means.
No, and they were given a compass bearing to move forward. So they were advancing into country that they blind. So when they turn up in the vicinity of Waugo, there are British troops there, but there's almost a friendly firefight.
Oh.
So they weren't expecting the
No.
reserves. The reserves didn't, the 8th Lincoln's 63rd Brigade didn't know who was there. But
No.
by all judgment, they actually arrived in the vicinity of Waugo, which is. This is where the punch from the general reserves was going to come, in between Ulluk and Hill 70. And what Haig wanted was for all the reserves to push through that, actually a very narrow gap,
Yeah.
and press on for another 5 miles or so.
That's a long way, isn't it, at this
It
stage of the
is.
war?
Indeed. But it took the 8th Lincoln set off at 10:30 in the morning, and they reached Waugo around about midnight. So they'd been on their feet for 14 hours when they got to Waugo. And they said, when the handover came, the tr British troops that were there said, "There you go, chaps, we're off." And they just disappeared into the night.
And what did that position actually look like then? Was that a second German line of defences inside a wood?
Just before the second German line of defense. So you've
Okay.
got the first German, the front line, you've got some trenches in front of Loos itself,
Yeah.
and then the second line was beyond Loos, so including Hill 70, and then they had the second line included a number of concrete bunkers with machine guns in them, and
Okay.
this constituted the second line. And there was a s very slight rise up to that second line. So if you ever go to Loos, and I'd recommend anybody to go there, you can walk the battlefield. It's as flat as the palm of your hand. But the German second line was heavily defended, as I say, with these concrete machine gun bunkers, and the German wire was 4 feet high but 20 feet deep,
Oh,
and
God.
that hadn't been touched at all. Like the original bombardment, the last 4 days on the German front line, there was gas and smoke, poisonous gas used for the first time, pretty much, and smoke as well. So when we came to the assault on the 26th, the next day, there wasn't obviously a 4 day bombardment. There was no gas and no smoke. And during the night, the Germans had rushed up 20,000 reserves into their front line.
That's not fair, is
So
it?
the second German line was more heavily defended on the 26th of September than the original front line had been on the day before.
They must have prepared for that, the Germans, mustn't they? They must have done, surely.
The thing was, they could rush their troops up by train.
Yeah, they got the train lines behind the lines, haven't they? That are still
Yeah,
there. Yeah,
they've
of
got all of
course.
that infrastructure there. I
Yeah.
mean, you've got to say that the Germans were very, very worried that there might be a breakthrough. Testimony from German prisoners of war, but the Germans reacted so quickly. I think, well, certainly for me, that was very surprising. As I say, the second line was more strongly defended, and they got the additional factors of no gas, no smoke, no. It was a bit of a preliminary bombardment, but not obviously as strong. And one of the things about the artillery for the 21st Division is that they did not have any trench maps.
So they didn't know where they were
Just let
firing.
that sink in a moment. So
Oh.
when people, they'd get to receive orders from the front line, say, "Can you please bombard permit the position, give the trench references?" And so they just fired long because they
Boy.
had no idea where the British soldiers were.
Yeah.
There was a battery of 21st Division exposed. Once the morning mist had risen, the Germans could see them, and that ended badly for them.
So I suppose they're firing long as well because they don't want to land
Yeah,
on their own
that's
men.
right.
And the other thing is with the artillery barrage is that the creeping barrage, which was so successful later on, is way off at this stage. This is another
That's
year
right.
away before that comes in.
Yeah. One of the other difficulties about this action is that Hill 70 was key, and at 9 o'clock in the morning on the 26th of September, what was left of 15th Scottish Division and 20 sorry 62nd Brigade attacked it. However, they suffered from friendly artillery fire. And the Germans were, it was a redoubt, and they were pushed out of that and back down towards Loos. So when you stood on the ground where Hill 70 is, it is actually a hill, and you could
Yeah.
see down it towards Loos itself.
Well, it's an
And
amazing view, isn't it? Because from there you can see right the way back beyond Lewes to the
yes,
British starting and beyond the British starting positions as well, so you can see what's going on.
But by not capturing Hill 70, it meant that when the General Reserves attacked later in the day, and that was now set at 11 a.m.,
Gosh.
those troops would suffer from enfilade fire from Hill 70 and also from Ulluk. So that little gap that they're trying to push through, they got enfilade fire from Ulluk, Hill 70, and fire from in front of them as well. But what happened was that the Germans counterattacked at 10, around about 10:30.
Before they've
So,
even had a chance to attack themselves, the Germans have
indeed.
counterattacked their positions.
Indeed. So, what happened is that Tom Nichols, who was commanding 63rd Brigade, he wanted to crack on early in the morning.
Yeah.
And he was, a staff officer arrived and was told to wait. You know, the general advance is going to be at 11 o'clock. And so he called an officers' meeting. It was like a there's a red house in the vicinity of Chalk Pit and Chalk Pit Wood. And on the way, Harold Walter from the 8th Lincolns, they were caught in an artillery bombardment. So there was him and another battalion commander. So he had the other guy, whose name escapes me at the moment, he collected three shrapnel balls in the shoulder. So he was out of action and wounded.
Yeah.
Walter was completely deaf from the explosions. And then the Germans are counter-attacking at around about the same time. So the crucial point for 63rd Brigade, and then you've got 8th Lincolns, you've got West Yorkshire's Somerset Light Infantry, who are in the Chalk Pit, and Yorks and Lancs. So the Lincolns are in and around Watwego itself. So you've got one company facing south, looking towards Hill 70, and the other three companies strung out to the north of Watwego, and then you've got the other two battalions, but their flank is left completely in the open. They
and also from what you're saying is they've committed all four companies as well. They haven't left one behind.
Yes.
All four have gone.
No. They're all there.
Yeah.
So in the Germans were able to infiltrate through the wood, Watwego itself, and then at 10:30 they just poured out of the wood and assaulted the 8th Lincolns. They brought a Maxim machine gun into the wood itself, and it was unfortunate that Strongquist ordered his men to cross in front of that, and that's where a significant number of casualties occurred. And then the Yorks and Lancs and the West Yorkshires retired from where they were. But there were no trenches at all.
No.
This was like little rifle pits, perhaps only 2 feet deep.
Right.
To get through the soil, of course, you hit hard chalk.
Mm.
Now, the entrenching tools, you know, picks and shovels and barbed wire had been left behind because the senior officers wanted to push them on as fast as they could. I think this is down to Haking as well. And so they only had their little hand entrenching tools, which really weren't very good.
Just bounce off it, wouldn't it?
Rifle pits were connected up.
Yeah.
So when the Germans pulled out of the trenches, there was a pretty much hand-to-hand fighting. And in that period, Lieutenant Colonel Harold Walter was mortally wounded.
Right.
Was attempting to lead a bayonet charge against the Germans. A number of McNaught Davis, who was a company commander, a captain, went to his aid. And then he and a lieutenant called Alcock, they are in these little pits until about 6:30 at night. So part of the controversy about the Battle of Loos is that the general reserves were routed, they ran away.
Yes, bolted.
Not as clear-cut and as simple as that.
Yeah.
Because there was at least a good number of 8th Lincolns in those little pits to the north of the wood itself. And the 8th Somerset Light Infantry was still established in the chalk pit itself. So they acted as a buffer to the Germans coming towards them. But what did happen is that the Germans got behind them, so they were in Puy 14, you know, that little winding station that's opposite the light airfield.
Yes.
Near Watwego. So they were taking enfilade fire, fire from the front, and reverse fire as well. They were having to rob their own comrades of the dead comrades of ammunition and water.
Yeah.
And by 6:30, every single officer was wounded and they'd run out of ammunition. The Germans surrounded them with machine guns and, you know, those were captured and taken prisoner of war. So there were probably about just over 100 taken prisoners of war. The 8th Somerset Light Infantry were ordered to retire from their position. And then, of course, the guards who were still in that traffic jam trying to get up to the front arrive on the 27th, but they weren't able to make any more headway than the 63rd Brigade had. I mean, when the general attack went in, rather than having two full divisions, Haig had borrowed and taken away a couple of brigades to help others. So 62nd Brigade went to 15th Division to attack Hill 70.
Yeah.
And then one of the brigades from, I think it was 74th, from the 24th Division went off towards the quarries and, you know, the dump and around that area.
Yeah, so the Hohenzollern,
So when the attack went in, rather than having six full battalions, sorry, brigades, you had three. Two from 24th Division and one from 21st Division.
So in my mind then, in my head, I can visualise now them being attacks from different sides, Germans got round them, taking prisoners, wounded, dead. Anyone? How did anyone get out of that?
Well, because there were retirements from the front, so those men that stayed and fought right to the end, they were all captured and taken prisoner of war.
Yeah,
we have about 150 more remembered on the Loos Memorial to the Missing. There are all of 11 named burials for the 8th Lincolns.
Just 11.
Just 11 with no grave. So about 400 casualties, which represents 40% of the other ranks. But interestingly, every single officer that went into action was a casualty, either wounded, killed, or missing prisoner of war.
And I suppose the officers are quite distinctive in what they're wearing at that stage
as
well,
yes,
aren't
they would
they?
Have their Sam Brown belts, carrying a sword, shirt
pistol.
And tie. So originally, when the 8th Lincolns arrived at the battle, there were 28 officers and almost 1,000 men.
Right, so full strength.
So when the roll call on the 29th of September came, there were just six officers. So four of those had been sent back to be out the way.
Yes.
And then two returning wounded.
Yeah.
But the ordinary ranks were just 552. So,
right.
You know, where are those other 500 men?
Yeah.
And I think a good, you know, 100 or so of them are captured. 100 or so of them are missing, never to be found. The 8th Lincolns took more casualties than any other battalion in 63rd Brigade.
Didn't that brigade?
Really had a very torrid introduction to the war. I mean, remember, this was the very first time they'd ever been in action.
Yeah.
The very first time they'd ever had bullet or shell fired against them.
Yeah. And they only arrived 2 weeks earlier.
That's right, 10th of
in
September.
France.
Yes.
It's a bit different from doing route marches around, you know, the villages wherever they were based in England, and practicing attacks to being involved in something like this with a cloth cap on their head, not a steel helmet.
Yes. No steel helmets. The training was challenging for them because they were K3. You know, uniforms came late.
Yeah.
Rifles came late.
Yeah.
Training came late. So they were training with the old Japanese rifles.
Right.
There was some testimony from an ordinary ranker who said we had lead weights in our pouches to replicate bullets because they
To make
didn't
them
actually
heavy.
have it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the artillery didn't get to fire until July
Right.
1915. So, you know, very short time before they were sent overseas.
Right.
What we could do, though, was route marching. I think they, you know, that was their principal thing.
Yeah, that's standard, isn't it?
Fitness and route marching. And
Yeah.
one of the things about the aftermath of the battle is that Haking and Haig himself accused those Kitchener volunteers of poor march discipline, getting lost on the way, which I think is bad form, actually.
Well, you must feel personally strong about that, knowing that your relative
Yes.
was there. And
Yeah.
he's talking about it. Was it your great grandfather, you said?
It was my great
Yeah,
grandfather,
he's
yeah.
talking about him. So that must be a personal insult, really, isn't it, to your family?
Yes. Men are throwing their rifles away. He
And
said all three
bolting.
rifles are thrown away, but how would he know
I
that?
was going
I
to
don't
say,
know.
how would he know? Who's
Yeah.
told him that? He hasn't got any camera, has he? He hasn't got
No.
any CCTV. What happened to those men that were captured then? They went off to prisoner of war camps, and they've got
Yeah.
3 and a half years in a prisoner of war camp. Did many of them come back from that?
Yes. So it depended on how severely wounded they were.
Yeah.
Some men were sent home back to England early. But Lionel Mountnort Davis, who was the company commander, he was shot in the head, so had a fractured skull, but ended up in a German prisoner of war camp. But of course, officers were treated differently.
Yeah.
So they weren't forced to work, whereas ordinary rankers were.
Yeah, it'll weaken them. If he got
Yeah.
shot in the head, how on earth did he survive?
Well, this is the thing. He complained about having severe headaches for 4 years. I don't think he had fantastic treatment
No.
by the Germans. But before it, when he was a soldier before the war, he was like a senior draftsman. So when I saw his archive, there were some like beautiful drawings and paintings
Right.
of prisons in which he had been held. But not Davis. I mean, his archive is held in the Rutherton Library at Leeds University, which is
Yeah.
well worth a visit if people are interested in the Eighth Lincolns. But so, like I say, I went to see his grandson. I took his grandson on a guided tour of the Loos battlefield as well, which was a huge privilege. But yeah, not Davis. I think did as much as he could. He was one of those officers that was in the little trench,
Yeah.
rifle pits
Yeah.
that hung on right to the end until about 6:30 on the 26th of September.
And did he come home and live to an old age then?
Yes, he came home and resumed sort of a career in architecture or drawing, like many
And went on to
did.
have a family because you said you took
Yeah.
his grandson out there. How did
Yeah.
his grandson feel when he was stood on that spot?
I think that's difficult to describe, actually, Terry, because I mean, it feels im so important for me. And my great grandfather, sort of came home, and but Paul's great grandfather was there and was, we know that he was fighting right through to the bitter end of the day, and then we know that he was a prisoner of war for the next 3.5 years or so. So, yeah, he was the one that ran out to Lieutenant Colonel Harold Walter to try and help him. I think Mcnaught Davis personally led bayonet charges against the Germans as well. But
And the other thing that I always think about in this situation is what goes through a soldier's mind at the point of surrender? Because someone's got a white handkerchief and attached it to a bayonet or something. They don't know what's going to happen next, do they?
No. I think the fear is that you're going to be killed outright,
That's right. Yeah,
that you'll
there
be
and then.
shot and shot dead.
Yeah.
I've thought about this a lot actually, because my own great grandfather was taken prisoner of war in 1918, and family story is that the German soldier hit my great grandfather in the face with the butt of his rifle. That probably would have quietened him down somewhat.
And that was at the point of capture, at the point when he
At
put
the
his arm.
point of capture,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, we'll never know, will we? We'll never know what
No.
that was like. The battlefield today, then, the wood itself, is it still there? Does it look exactly
It's
the
still
same?
there.
Yeah.
So there's less of it,
Yeah.
but it's still there. So it ran where Puy 14 still is. The wood
Yeah.
ran up to that road that intersects there. And what we have there now is the Lons Light Airfield. So
Yes.
you can tell how flat it is because they've just cut the wood down and then they run little light aircraft off there. There's a very good restaurant there called the Hurricane Bar if you ever need a
That's always
some
useful
lovely
to know, isn't it?
food.
It's always useful to
Yes.
know because sometimes we do lack places.
And then there's a children's play area with animals and stuff like that. And then there's a on the other side of it is a huge shopping complex.
Yeah.
You're not far from Lons there anyway.
No.
Shopping and restaurants and stuff like that. It's an interesting place to go, I think. Not visited enough, in my
No, it
view.
isn't. No, we do say this. People tend to go down it, they pass it on their way to the Somme and don't even realise what they're passing. Or even if they're going down from Ypres down to the Somme, you know, oh, what are those piles over there that people ask, being the slag heaps from the mining, and then they don't realise that, you know, oh, there was a battle there, Battle of Loos, and they look at you that they've never heard of it, a lot of people. You know, but it's so important, and of what happened there. These men then that died or were killed or died of wounds, how are they remembered? Obviously, their names are on the Loos Memorial, and you said that some of them, a few, was it 11 of them had got a grave?
Yes, one in England and 10 in France.
So one's got home and died of wounds. 10 are buried out there, and then you've got the 100 or so that is on the Loos Memorial around the cemetery. But is there any battalion memorial or divisional memorial there?
21st Division doesn't have a division memorial, interestingly. The only sort of memorial to it is something that the Western Front Association put up on the butt at Warlencourt some years ago.
Yeah.
The 8th Lincolns are remembered on the 37th Division Memorial at Monchy in
Monty, yeah.
Arras,
Yeah.
as a part of the Battle of Arras.
But nothing on the Loos battlefield. Nothing. If we weren't
Nothing.
talking about this, if you hadn't written the book, no one would even know anything about this, would they?
I mean, the Canadians are remembered there because the
Yeah.
Canadians took Hill 70 in 1917,
Yeah.
and pretty much they just blasted the Germans off the hill. It's 1,000 guns attacking them or something like
And if
that.
people haven't been, again, I've been to Hill 70 several times. I've never seen anyone else there. And there's a number of information boards there. There's a fantastic view. And it's just up the road from the Loos Cemetery, isn't it? And the new extension. It's just up the road from there. So people should go there. It's worth it to just to understand not just the 1915 or 1916 fighting took place there, but the conquering of it. I think it was in August 17, was it, by the Canadians? Yeah.
If you go to the Loos Memorial to the Missing, they've got their viewing towers, so you can
Yes.
climb to the top of the towers there.
Yes.
You can see the entire battlefield just
Yes.
about
Yeah.
from and I think that's a very worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah,
And then
definitely.
if you go to the 8th Lincoln's panel, you can see the 150 or so men's names, including the Bosworth brothers. So they were two junior officers.
They were from here. They were from Northampton.
Yes, that's right.
It just suddenly occurred to me. Yeah, I went and saw their name last time I went there, and I've got them written down on a piece of paper to look into them. I think they were brothers, weren't they? And they both died on the same day.
They were both killed on the same day. One of them had been an explorer out in South America
That's right.
when the
Yeah.
war started, and he came home and then obviously got his commission and was a part of the 8th Lincolns, and his other brother sadly was killed on the same day.
Yeah,
So
yeah,
it must
yeah.
have been a terrible
Well,
day for the family getting those
that's
tallies
only just occurred
around.
to me. Just as you said that, I suddenly remembered the two brothers, and I couldn't remember their names until you just said it. It's an amazing coincidence. So, after that, then your great grandfather's obviously survived, which is great news. How did they then rebuild the battalion? Because they went on, as you said, with your great grandfather before we started recording. He went on and fought in the great battles after this, didn't he? Before he was captured.
So immediately after the Battle of Loos, there was a, I think it was a Lieutenant Patterson, 19 years old, took command of the battalion.
19.
19. They made him a temporary major until they could find a more senior officer.
Because that's all they've got
There was
left.
a series of officers joined, and were almost immediately wounded upon arrival. But then the battalion was obviously, you need replacements. The new colonel trained them hard, particularly around using bombs and rifle grenades. And so they took part as a part of 21st Division's attack on the 1st of July on the Somme,
Yeah.
and actually burst into the German trenches. So they weren't they were like the reserve battalion. So you know where Freikorps German Cemetery is? They were in the vicinity there. So as you look at the cemetery, if you just walk up the road a little way, the hill climbs a little bit, and then it's Freikorps Farm. They went through the trench systems there. They ended up capturing Lozenge Alley Trench.
I've seen that
So there
marked
was a
on the
big
maps.
firefight between them and the Bavarian regiment that was there, mostly grenades fighting each other.
So your great grandfather's got through that.
He's got through that. And one of the survivors from the Battle of Loos, what was his name? Cordiner, he was awarded a military cross for his actions there. He'd been wounded and then got wounded in the face again, but continued fighting and organizing the men and
How do
so on
they
and so
do that?
forth.
How do they
But
do that? If
unfortunately,
you've been hit in the head, how do you then
I
think,
know.
oh, I know, I won't go down on the ground. I'll organize everyone around me.
Incredible, isn't it? So they took part on the 1st of July, and because of casualties, they were like taken out, rest and refit, and then they found themselves on the Somme again at the Battle of Ancre in November 1916. So they actually replaced, as a battalion, the entire Royal Naval Division. Well, what was left of them at
Beaucourt.
Beaucourt. So I've walked that ground as well, because you can see Thiep Val from Beaucourt, can't you? Where
It's a
the
very steep hill, isn't it, up there?
it is, yes. So they were on the Somme, and then at that point, my great grandfather was wounded at Beaucourt, and so he was home for about 6 months. Oh, sorry, he wasn't. He was home for about almost an entire year.
So
If
does
my
that mean
yeah.
he's missed Arras then? He's missed Arras and Montreux.
No, he doesn't miss Arras. So he's discharged from hospital January 1917, and then is transferred to the 7th Lincolns, and then to the 2nd 5th Lincolns, and then eventually get transferred when they're destroyed, gets transferred to the 1st Lincolns. But he's fighting to the 63rd Brigade, is transferred into 37th Division. 37th Division, of course, fighting at the Battle of Arras. And they have that beautiful memorial with the three soldiers on the top of the cairn. So they're involved in that. And then, of course, the German assault of the spring of 1918, and where many, many divisions were, roughly treated, let's say. The 2nd, 5th Lincolns, which my great grandfather was in, part of 59th, 2nd North Midland Division. And they were, there was very little left of them. And they got sent up to Balliol and got hit again by the second German assault, and then disbanded. And that in the First Lincoln's War Diary, you see an entry saying that the men from 2nd, 5th Lincoln's had arrived.
They're doing that.
So yeah, I mean, they just kept going, just kept going.
And then your relative then you mentioned is captured at the point of a rifle butt in the last few weeks of the war. And off he goes to Germany, and then he comes home. And you said you mentioned that you knew him. He was still
No,
around when you were little.
mum knew him.
Your mum
He
knew him.
passed away before I was born. Interestingly enough, though, Terry, he was a part of the Home Guard. So he was a member of the Home Guard from 40 through to 44. And then the little certificate and the medal to go along with that. So,
Got one here for my dad up here. He remembered that. I mean, what I always used to tease my dad. What exactly? Me and dad were down in Kent, so had the Germans invaded, he'd have been on the front line defences. What exactly were you going to do with that wooden stick? But that's another story, isn't it, for another
it's
day.
another
Back
story.
home in Lincoln, then being the county town or the county city, are there any memorials to them there?
No.
No,
I
at
went to
all.
Lincoln Cathedral thinking that there might be something there.
It's all about tanks, isn't
It
it?
is. I spoke to the curator at Lincoln Cathedral, and he really had no idea what I was talking about, bless him. There was a huge memorial to the Royal Air Force, of course, but
Makes it
nothing
even more
to.
important then, doesn't it, that we're talking about it today? So where can you mention you've written another book as well. What was the second book about then?
So the second book's on the 2nd Battalion Leicestershire Regiment.
Right, which is where you said you live now. You've moved to Leicester, so
That's right,
you've got an
yes.
interest in
So
them.
that covers the entire war.
Yeah.
So they're in India at the beginning of the war, come over with the Indian Corps,
As they're regulars.
fight all
Yeah.
the battles from 1914, including the Battle of Loos, where they are involved in a diversionary attack just north of Neuve-Chapelle. And after that, they are then transferred to Mesopotamia, modern day Iraq, and they are part of the Tigris Corps, the relief for Townsend at Kut Alamara. After that, they're involved in the advance and to the capture of Baghdad in 1917,
Gosh.
and then they're transferred to Palestine in 1918 to finish off the Turks and the Germans in Palestine.
That's a very different story, isn't it,
It is a very, very
on
different
the Western
story.
Front, which is good news. So
Yeah.
the book that you wrote about the Eighth Lincolns, just remind us what it's called.
It's called In the Shadow of Bois Hugo.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you're in the process of well, there it is there, yeah. And we'll put a link to that on the
Oh, thank you.
website, on our podcast page on the website. And people can get it from all the usual places that it's still available,
Yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
From Amazon. And you're in the process of writing another book, you mentioned.
Yeah, so I'm writing a volume on the 59th Division, which is 2nd North Midland Division.
Yeah.
So again, my great grandfather partly influenced my decision on that, in
Yes.
that he was in the 2nd 5th Lincolns, which were part of 59th Div.
So it's like a bigger picture then, isn't it? If it's a divisional
Yes.
story rather than a
Yeah.
battalion.
So interestingly, they started their war in Dublin in 1916.
Right.
And then when they were transferred to France, the Germans had retreated to the Hindenburg
Yeah.
line. And then, in the nine battles of 1917, Passchendaele, and then the German assault in the spring of 1918, the entire division suffered very, very badly at the hands of the Germans there. I don't think there is, at the moment, a 59th Division divisional history. There's
No,
a
no.
collection of essays that officers put together
Yes.
in the early 1920s, but there isn't an actual
No.
59th Division
And how are you getting on with
volume.
that? Is it, have you finished it yet? Is it ready for
No,
publishing? No.
I've written the first 20,000 words.
Right.
So I've done a bit on recruitment and training.
Yeah.
There's a whole chapter on the actions at Dublin. I've just arrived at the point of I'm writing up their very first action on the Western Front,
So you're doing
which
it
is,
in chronological order, which is
yes,
logical, isn't it, for us? Excellent. Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for all that. That's really useful. And hopefully it will encourage people not just to buy your books, but to take the book and travel out to the battlefield and walk the battlefield, because there's still so much to not just see, but I think experience. You can feel the atmosphere when you read the personal accounts and you look at the lie of the land and you see the woods and the Hill 70 above you and where Tower Bridge was. And then you look back, you can understand exactly, and look at the flat battlefield, so you can see how enfilade fought. All those things you can only experience if you go there, can't you? You can't do it.
That's
You can't
right.
do it from an office or watching a documentary. But thank you very much for that, and we'll do it again another time.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
So I don't know about you, but I found that fascinating. We never ever stop learning about these battles. I think we've done two or three podcasts about this particular battle, which, as we said during that episode, there are a lot of people are not even aware that it happened. If they are aware that it's happened, they know very little about it. But as with all of these actions, there are so many personal stories that come out of them. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast about another one of these many soldiers that has been discovered on the battlefield and then identified and then reburied with full military honours. And there's a lot of these happening at the moment. And I just wanted to mention one of them, a Sergeant Richard Rounsley, who was serving with the 12th Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry. And a burial service for him took place on the Somme last week at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, the Wallancourt British Cemetery. He was buried alongside an unknown soldier, no doubt a comrade of his. and another unknown soldier of a regiment that they couldn't establish. There was no identification on him at all. But the three of them were all found during the installation of one of those enormous wood turbines near the village of Lasar, close to what had been the Bladen Trench in 1916. Now, Sergeant Rounsley came from a place called Tanfield in County Durham, and he died on the 5th of October 1916 when his battalion was in the support lines and he was 30 years old. Now, that area had been heavily shelled for several days. These are those dreadful last few weeks of the Battle of the Somme. The weather, as we know, was absolutely awful. It was recorded that the rain was continuous during their entire time in those support trenches, and the ground was described as being practically impossible for military operations. Now, when they found the remains of Rounsley, he was identified using DNA testing, and we know that he was a father of four children, and of course his death had a profound impact on the lives of his widows and those young children. The service was attended by three branches of his family and included one of his grandchildren. The service was conducted by the Reverend John Storey, chaplain of the 5th Battalion, the Rifles, and was supported by serving soldiers of that battalion. Richard's identity has been established. The other soldier that they know was serving with the Durham Light Infantry no doubt found a cap badge on him. The work to try and identify him will continue. They're no doubt taking DNA from his body before he was buried. Let's hope that one day that his headstone that says an unknown soldier of the Durham Light Infantry will be replaced with the details of that man, and his story can end in a military burial. We remember all of those men that died at Lewes serving with the 8th Lincolns, and we remember Sergeant Richard Rounsley by the plane of the Last Post.